You're listening to Equip Season 5, Understanding and Interpreting the Bible. This is Week 1, The Gospels, taught by Dr. Jonathan Pennington, an author and professor of New Testament interpretation. This week's participants are Andrew and Kristen Gish and LeVar Allen. You're on Session 3.
Okay, so far we've talked about what the Gospels are, why do we need them, and now we want to get really practical and just ask, how do you actually read a Gospel story? And there are two things I really want to talk about here. One is seeing each Gospel story as part of a whole series of stories, and I'll explain that, and then talk a little bit more about what specifically to do when you look at a Gospel story. So to start, we need to remember the genre. They are stories. And the biggest thing you take away from that is to recognize that you don't read a story the same way you read like the letter to the Romans or 2 Corinthians or 1 Peter, which are letters, which when you read a letter that's really trying to make an argument, you follow it logically through. This point is building on and then making this point, and then maybe there's a therefore this point. That's not how stories work. Stories are not arguments. They are an adventure in the sense that how a story works, a story is built on plot. And what plot is tension and release. Tension and release. And what that means, in fact, as soon as I say this, you'll recognize what you love about stories and what every story does, it has some problem. Something happens that causes a problem. And then that story, that problem either gets resolved in a good way, and that's what we would technically call a comedy, or it gets resolved in a bad way, that's what we call a tragedy, right? But every story has this tension and release. That's very different than reading like an epistle or an argument. And so that's the number one thing to talk about when you think about reading a story and interpreting a Gospel story, is let it be a story. In other words, you don't just read a verse and then say, what does this mean to me? And then read another verse. What does this mean? You take the whole thing in and then ask, what's this saying? And so that's very different than reading an epistle or something. So that's the big idea. So what I thought would be helpful to do is to actually look at some examples of this and just a couple examples we could look at to think about how to read a story and then how to read a story very particularly, and also how it fits into others. So I'm going to start, think of it like a funnel. Okay. So we're going to be in Matthew 14 and following. You can turn there if you want. But if you think about a Gospel story, let's think about the kind of the top of the funnel. That is that a Gospel story is part of the whole canon of the Bible. So again, we believe that the Bible is all written by God ultimately, even though it's written by different authors over, you know, a couple thousand years even, but we believe God's the ultimate author behind it. So any Gospel story is going to be part of the whole Bible, and we should always be asking, how does this story relate to other parts of the Bible? Any Gospel story is also part of the four Gospels together. And we didn't really talk about this before, but Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, in the earliest centuries of the church, were really considered one book. Now we think of them as four separate books. But in the early centuries, they were referred to as the gospel, singular gospel, according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And so that's a good thing to remember, that when we're studying a Gospel story, it's intentionally aware of the other gospels as well. And it's, you know, it's not the first thing we should do. We shouldn't just be jumping from one story to another. But we'll often have parallel stories that can be helpful to help us understand that. So top of the funnel is the whole Bible. Next is the fourfold gospel book, the gospel. But then to recognize that whenever we're reading a story in the Gospels, it's not just there kind of randomly. It's part of a bunch of other stories around it. In other words, God has inspired Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to tell a really good story. And just like if you were reading a novel or a biography, you wouldn't just turn to some middle page in the book, right? And like, let's say you're reading an Agatha Christie or, a murder mystery of some sort or something, if maybe a movie form like Knives Out or something, you wouldn't just like go to minute 74 and just try to understand it, right? You'd recognize, oh, this scene, this little sub story is part of a larger story. Well, that's true for the Gospels too. Like the Gospels are not just this random collection of things Jesus said one day put together. It's all crafted together. So we're told about Jesus' birth at the beginning. We're told about his life and then his death and resurrection at the end. So it's all a narrative like that. And it doesn't, hear me clear, it doesn't mean every time we read a gospel story, we have to read the whole gospel. Like that's not realistic. Right. But it's at least to be aware that whenever I'm jumping into a story, I'm jumping into something that Matthew is telling me a bigger story. And the more we can pay attention to the whole story, the better. So let's turn to Matthew 14, recognizing that there are 13 chapters that came before it, right? And that those matter. But particularly, what I want to encourage you to do to think about stories, and what I'm about to show you is something you can do on your own, right? You can do it in your small group. You can do it in your own personal study. And it's really just a habit or a sensibility, a training to think about each individual story as part of a larger collection of stories. So I'll just tell you what the collection is. The collection of stories here is Matthew chapters 14, 15, 16, and 17. So that's kind of one big unit in Matthew. And so what I want to invite you to do, and if in your, we can do it here together, or maybe people even want to pause the recording and maybe do this in your community group, might be good to do, depending on your time. But the habit I want to inculcate in you is to paying attention. Are there themes or repeated ideas? Are there patterns as you look at a bunch of stories together, not just looking at the individual story? We're going to look at an individual story in a minute, but first to think, are there any patterns? So if you look at chapters 14, 15, 16, and 17 in Matthew, and do what I like to call, look for divine crop circles. You know what I mean by that? So like you could be walking through a cornfield and you could get some, you know, heads of corn and it's cool and everything. But if you get up to like a couple thousand feet up in a tower or on a small airplane, you look down and you realize, oh, there's actually a pattern here. That they're, you know, crop circles, you know what I mean? You know, magically there or something, but that God has put patterns into these stories. So let me ask you, take a minute and look. Are there any things you see that are kind of repeated across chapters 14, 15, 16, and 17 that strike you?
The miracles or the healings.
Definitely a lot of healings, and particularly what miracles happen. There are two. There's one miracle that's repeated twice here. What's the big one? Pretty famous. And this is where your little headings on our stories can be helpful to us, because we're doing this kind of quickly, I realize.
And he feeds thousands to 5,000.
Yeah, so he's got, there are two of these miraculous wilderness feedings. You see that? Mm-hmm. Okay. That's not an accident that there are two of these in the same unit. Mm-hmm. Do you notice there's also a couple of times that he crosses over water? Mm-hmm. For example, in 14:22 and following, and then it's very brief in the second one in 15:39. Again, both times he feeds miraculously in the wilderness, and then he crosses over water. Okay. Well, let me just show a few things. I know, you know, I've been doing this a long time. This is my first rodeo. And so, but even if you don't see things initially, I want to encourage you, you can do this. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be the son of an English professor like I am, or be a student of the New Testament professionally like I am. Anybody can learn to do this. I really want to encourage you in that by just paying attention to the patterns of stories. But if you look, one of the threads that ties these chapters together is food. So you have John the Baptist, who is beheaded. This is the third part of the John the Baptist story. We met him in chapter 3 of Matthew, where he was preaching. We met him in chapter 11 when he's in prison. Now this is the tragic story of his death. And it happens at a feast. It happens at a horrible feast, a feast of drunkenness by the 1% elite people in society when most people are starving. This is the Herodian household feast. And it's when you read chapter 14, 1 to 12, you should feel gross. Because what happens in this story is that Herod gets this is not Herod the Great who tried to kill Jesus. This is one of his sons. So 30 years later, Herod the Great, who's now married to his sister-in-law, his former sister-in-law, gets so drunk with his friends that he's lusting over his stepdaughter when she dances for them. And as a result, drunkenly, he says, I'll give you whatever you want, up to half my kingdom. So her mother, who doesn't like John the Baptist because he was preaching against her adultery with her new husband, she sees this as an opportunity to get John the Baptist killed. So she sends her daughter in there, this poor young girl being used as a sex object and then used in this manipulative way that results in the beheading of this great prophet of God. Mm-hmm. You should read that story and feel gross mm-hmm. because it's meant to. But notice what happens in the next story. You actually have another feast. Mm-hmm. But it's a feast that could not be more different than this feast. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a feast where Jesus, who's a good shepherd, who's actually the true king, not like this Herod guy. Jesus is the true king who has great compassion on people. And not in a drunken feast, but in love, he feeds them miraculously in the wilderness. And rather than having a hangover, what does it say at the end? They ate and were satisfied. This is such a picture. And these two stories next to each other is what in Greek would be called synchrisis, that is teaching by comparison. In other words, we could read Matthew 14, 1 to 12 about John the Baptist's beheading and get a lot out of it by itself. We could also read Matthew 14, 13 and following and get a lot out of the feeding of the 5,000 story. But when you read them next to each other, and learn to just ask a question you've never maybe asked yourself, why is this story after this one?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And again, you can do this. Mm-hmm. Anybody can do this. If you just start asking, why is this story here? And is there a pattern between them? You see that there is this synchrisis or this contrast of teachings, contrast of examples that's even more powerful than just a straight up teaching by showing us the example. It's a little bit more subtle, right? But you can see it. And then if you keep reading, what's the next story? A miraculous water
walking
crossing.
On water. Yeah.
Now there's so much, you know, we don't have time to get into all of this. We'll come back to this story in particular in just a minute. But what I want to point out is if you keep reading through these stories, you will see that there's a pattern. You're not going to see it on your first reading, maybe not on your 20th reading, but that's why I'm here to help you see this. There is a pattern throughout all these stories that is intentionally imitating, or what we call in Greek, it's mimetic. It means imitation. Mm-hmm. It's imitating the stories of the Exodus. Because if you think back to the most important event in Israel's history, when God rescued them out of Egypt, what you see in those stories are exactly these same stories being imitated. That is, what do you have? Miraculous feeding in the wilderness of the Israelites. Mm-hmm. Miraculous water crossing mm-hmm. where they cross through the Red Sea. And then that continues, that keeps mimetically working its way out because then the Israelites miraculously cross the Jordan River twice. Mm-hmm. That itself is imitating back to the original Red Sea. And then if you keep reading, mm-hmm. you see a Canaanite woman appear, which is very interesting, isn't it? Because in Jesus' day, there weren't any Canaanites left. This is an old term to refer to the people who opposed the Israelites when they came through. These are the people that most fiercely opposed the Israelites when they entered the promised land, right? And they weren't actually even driven out finally until the time of David. It took them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years to finally drive all the Canaanites mm-hmm. out, and David is the one who finally does it. This is very interesting that this woman who Mark calls a Syrophoenician woman, which is where she's from, is given this kind of OG title and intentionally to remind the readers of the Exodus. And notice the contrast. This Canaanite woman, this one who'd be an enemy of God, responds to Jesus in great faith. Mm-hmm. But the people who are the leaders of the Jewish people right before this, they are completely opposed to Jesus. Do you see this? This is synchrisis. This is teaching by comparison. The Jerusalemites are opposed to Jesus. The Canaanite woman responds in faith. And if you keep reading on, you can see the same thing happens in chapter 16. Then in chapter 17, what, when you have what we call the transfiguration, what in the Exodus does that sound like? Does that ring a bell with anything? This is all Exodus, but what happens to Moses? Do you remember?
His face shines.
Yes, radiant. Exactly. The exact same verbiage is used here with Jesus as a greater one than Moses, who also experiences in front of Peter and James. And notice who's there at the transfiguration, Moses and Elijah, right? These two crucial people from Israel's story. So my point is, I'm doing a quick version of it. All throughout these chapters, there's something going on that is deeper than the individual stories. The individual stories are great.
Yeah.
But when you start to look for the divine crop circles, you start to look for the patterns, you see that God is doing more than just telling us one individual thing. He's showing us that Jesus is bringing about a new Exodus. He's a new and greater Moses who feeds people miraculously, who leads people across water miraculously, who commends faith, and now with the radical twist, even a Gentile is welcome. And that's why there are two feedings. One of the feedings is for Jews, where there are 12 baskets left over. One feeding is for the Gentiles, where there are 7 baskets, which is the 12 is the number of Israel, 7 is the number of the universal. There's a 12 and 7 pattern here going on that's more complicated than I have time to get into. But this is all intentional, okay? Yeah. So the point is, friends, that this is part of the great joy of actually learning to read the Gospels is to read for larger patterns. Mm-hmm. Now, more briefly, to wrap this up, if you go now to an individual story, let's look back at 14, 22 to 33. What you do here, as I was starting to say at the beginning of this talk, is you look for tension and release. So at the big level, you're looking for patterns. And mimesis or imitation of the Old Testament. At the individual story level, you're looking for tension and release. And again, we'll have to be brief about this, but if you look at Matthew 14, 22 to 33, what you see is a buildup of attention. You have kind of a setup. Jesus makes the disciples get in the boat. They go head across the river to them. He's praying. Here you begin to get the tension rising. They are out on the lake. And there's, you know, they're buffeted by the waves, it says in 14:24. And then Jesus appears walking on the water, which would freak anybody out. I mean, being on a boat at night is already kind of freaky, if you've ever done that, right? But imagine if you saw some lit up figure coming across the water to you. Of course you'd think it's a ghost, right? And they're freaking out, even these professional fishermen. But Jesus says these words that are very intentionally going back to the burning bush. Notice the Exodus here again. Take courage, it is I, ego in me, or I am. I am who I am. That should remind you of God revealing himself at the Exodus, right? And then when divine agents show up always in the Old Testament, don't be afraid because they're afraid, right? And then the story doesn't end there. Now, that's how Mark ends his story. But Matthew adds this other part. So the tension's not over yet. Peter says, if it's you, tell me to come in the water. And Jesus graciously says, come. And so Peter actually begins to experience this kind of power of Jesus transferred to him. He begins to walk on water as well until he loses sight of Jesus and begins to look around at his circumstances, which is clearly meant as an illustration for us, and he begins to sink. And Jesus says, well, sucks to suck. Sorry you didn't have faith. And Peter dies. No, that's not what happens. Jesus is very gracious here.
Amen.
And reaches out his hand, even in the midst of Peter's struggle and his stumbling, and grabs him by the arm and says, come. I love you. And I can imagine when they climb back in the boat, they must have been just laughing and crying. Think of the beauty of this moment, like amazed. And look at their response. Jesus says, you have little faith. And I don't think he's rebuking them in a mean way. Why'd you doubt? Well, I think he understands why. He knows that we're dust and he knows what a freaky moment this was. But then look at their response. They climb in the boat, the wind dies down, right? And those who were with him in the boat worshiped him and said, truly, you're the Son of God. I'm tearing up just thinking about it. Yeah. The beauty of Jesus' grace to them and their awe.
Yeah.
And their wonder that they get to be part of this, right?
Yeah.
So what's going on in the story? Well, there's so much. What you want to look for is what's the tension and what's the high point of tension? And for me, I think the high point of tension is, it's not just Jesus saying, take courage, that's really important, but it's Peter beginning to
sink
and say, Lord, save me. And then the resolution of that tension is it's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. He says, he does, he grabs him, he reached out his hand and caught him. Mm. And then he does says, you have little faith. And again, I think with a smile on his face, he knows that we're Psalm 103. God remembers our frame, remembers that we are dust. And he says, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? So what you're looking for in this story is not just kind of some random thing, what I call the whatever strikes me method, where you just look at, well, I like that verse. Mm-hmm. What you're looking for in a story is, where's the high point of tension? Where's the moment where you're like, what's going to happen? Mm-hmm. And then what's the release of that? That's what God is usually saying in a story. Mm-hmm. And that's what you really want. There's a lot of things. The it is I is important. There's so many good things in here. The worshiping of him, it's all important. But what you're really looking for is, what's the point where you're like on the edge of your seat, and then how does that resolve? Mm-hmm. And again, I just want to encourage you, you can do this. Mm-hmm. All it requires is slowing down and paying attention. Mm-hmm. And the key to reading the Gospels well and reading them wisely is looking for tension and release in the individual stories and looking for big patterns across the stories, knowing that God has beautiful things for us in these stories. And this is the joy of studying the Gospels in this way.
Would this also work for parables as well, as far as the tension and release?
Yeah, the story kind of parables, mm-hmm. the ones that are more extended, they're going to be more compressed mm-hmm. than a story like this. But yeah, mm-hmm. I think so. Okay. Yep, it's a good question. Any other thoughts or questions?
I just like that at the end, their faith was strengthened after they witness this, you know, and I mean, a good miracle would do that, of course.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then we get to experience it too.
Right.
I mean, I could see your response even as I was telling the story, that God was stirring up some faith in you. I saw it. And that's the power of story, isn't it? Yeah. Like, we get to see Jesus doing something. It's so much more powerful than just hearing that he did this. You know what I mean? Like, to experience the story. So slow down. Live in these stories. Mm-hmm. Don't just try to extract. Don't read a story just to kind of extract out the truth. You'll get there, but live in the story. Mm-hmm. Feel what it would have felt like to be there. Taste the salt of the water on your lips and the feel of Jesus grabbing your arm and the tears of joy that they had. That's why God has given us stories, that we can enter into them and experience them. So don't be afraid to do that. There's life there for you.
Yeah, I really enjoyed. You point out the macro sense of how these were intentionally put together by the authors. Just, I don't know, you look through the Old Testament, every time God's just calling Israel back to faith, it's like, remember what I did back in Exodus, right? It's always looking back at that. And then, like, even here, you know, like, we tend to separate Old and New Testament and such, but in this case, like, even then, he's still saying, remember what I did, in a sense, and call back to the time that I delivered Israel and my faithfulness there.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm doing this through the Christ, through Jesus doing this and showing this exact same pattern, right?
Yeah.
Which is really cool, and I've never seen that.
The old callback, it's the best. It's the best for a stand-up comedy routine. It's the best for the Bible as well. That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very good.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a joy to talk with you guys about the Gospels, and I hope you will enjoy digging more deeply into them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.